place is different, special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them, but we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I am illicitly regifting, a la Gin and a Dog this week, candy that I've taken from a baby.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I am illicitly regifting free things I get from film and TV studios that I am not supposed to give to other people, but I do.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my illicit regift, I took this way too literally because I imagined myself going into a politician's home and beating them up and then taking whatever food, like if there's like a fully cooked turkey or something on the table, I'm just going to take that home and regift that.
To yourself? Because, to the dog? Well,
to whoever is around, okay. You know.
You there, boy, what day is it?
Exactly.
Excellent. We're here to talk about Lost Season 1, Episode 17. In translation, it's a gin episode. If this is your first time joining us, you should know we split the show into two different sections. The Calm, which you are in now and will be the first half of the podcast, that has no spoilers beyond In Translation, Episode 17 of the first season of Lost. The second section, we call The Storm. You'll see a time code for it in your podcast notes. Has all the spoilers about all the things that we've learned since Lost has ended after six season run on ABC. But we're still back. It's still back here in season one in our Lost rewatch. If you would like to support us, you can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We have three tiers of subscription. The highest one, the $10 level, gets you all sorts of audio bonuses, different podcasts. This week I would have, or I guess last week I would have explained Spider-Man to you because there was a whole bunch of Spider-Man drama and entertainment news. Meanwhile, Neil cleared up a whole bunch of specific drama about a chicken sandwich. It's really bonus content you cannot miss at patreon.com/StarWarsSpoilers. But more importantly, I feel this week you're going to get some extended content with our interviewee this week. Joanna, before we get to reviews, who do we have on this week?
We have, and forgive my white girl mouth as I say this, the writer of this episode, Javier Grillo Marxwatch, is joining us on the podcast. He was a writer for the first two seasons of Lost, and so we talk in this episode about this specific episode of Lost, also some first season stuff up to this episode. You will hear that all in the sort of guest portion of this episode that you're listening to right now. But for the larger lens look at the legacy of Lost and also, you know, some other ideas about the state of television and stuff like that, you're going to want to be a Patreon subscriber at the $10 level. Then you will get it in the bonus feed. Javi also plugged, his work on, The Dark Crystal, which should be dropping August, if you're listening to this, I think in like 2 days time, the Friday, August 30th. So, you know, we had a lot to talk about. It was a good interview.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We like hearing from people who actually worked on the show because we do a lot of speculating, both in the calm and the storm of this podcast. But we also like hearing from you, our listeners, in the form of iTunes reviews, which help other people find the storm. Joanna, do we have any iTunes reviews this week?
We do. We have a positive and a negative. Which one should I start with?
Let's do the positive. Let's do the kiss and slap.
All right. The old kiss and slap. All right. This one comes from Gin and Teacups. 5 stars. So glad I can finally listen in. I'm a huge fan of Fighting the Worm, Little Gold Men, and Cast of Kings. I was always bummed that I was missing out on more Joanna and Dave because I didn't want to know Game of Thrones spoilers. I'm so thrilled that I can now follow along with the Lost rewatch. Lost is one of my favorite shows when it was airing, despite the fact that I did a semester abroad in Australia where I was in fact able to get peanut butter shortly after the show began, and it made me, for the first time in my life, kind of scared to fly. But aside from a few specific episodes, I haven't rewatched the show since it ended. Getting to experience it, accompanied by Dave, Joanna, and Neil's discussion, any insights has become a highlight of my week. So that's the kiss. Here's the slap. Slap is from Jen Unstuck. Jen writes 3 stars. Love Lost, but this podcast, not so much. I keep listening, hoping that I will like the podcast more. I'm doing a Lost rewatch at the current time. I couldn't wait for episodes of the podcast, so I'm already beginning season 4. Been wanting to listen to an in-depth discussion of the episodes of Lost, but this podcast keeps not working out for me. Joanna talks over everyone, speaks so fast at times she is difficult to understand, and I just find her very annoying. I like the other 2 people, but don't even know their names because she overtakes everything about every episode. This seems like it would be a much more enjoyable podcast with less of her. So that is from Jen.
That's so dark. I disagree.
Yeah. That was like a 1-fingered slap of a possible 5-fingered hand. I was expecting something, you know, credible, but applying to all of us, not something not credible.
It's not exactly the exploding palm technique, I'll tell you that much.
It's okay. I mean, don't like people. It's fine.
What am I doing every week coming up with clever ways for us to say our full names and then something funny if it's not sticking? I don't know. I'm going to take that as part of a shot against me. I'll do better to hit that nail on the head.
So if you want to leave us a review to counteract that review, we would certainly take it. You can also sort of check out our website if you're new to the show, and check out our website for more information at stormpodcast.com. You can tweet at us or follow us on Twitter at stormpodcast. And you can email us host@stormpodcast.com, which is where we got this email from Rachel. Rachel writes in with a correction from our last episode. Rachel writes, "Okay, guys, I have a major correction for you from this week that is important to the Red Sox reference and timeline. You said the plane crashed on 8/15/04. That is incorrect. Oh. The date of the crash was the date of the show's premiere, 9/22/04. If Outlaws takes place on days 29 through 31, that puts it the week of October 20th, 2004, smack in the middle of the playoffs for the 2004 World Series. The Red Sox won on October 27th, 2004, so as of this episode, they had not yet won. Now ask me why I know all this. As you all know, I've been watching Lost with my now almost 15-year-old son. We are in season 6. He was 10 days old when the Red Sox won, and my husband watched it with him, bouncing this newborn baby around late into the night so I could get some sleep between feedings. I will always associate the Sox winning with the birth of my son, and strangely, the next time they won was the fall. My daughter was born in 2007. And then the rest of this email is a spoiler, which we are going to save for the storm section. But so you heard it here first, Red Sox. If you want to win again, make sure that Rachel has another baby.
I guess. Yeah, it's the baby.
It's the baby. So
that's what did it.
We'll save the back half of Rachel's email for the storm section. But that is from Rachel. So yeah, you can email us host@stormpodcast.com with your comments or corrections or whatever the case may be.
Hey, that's the name of an episode of Lost. Excellent. Neil, let's remind everybody where we are this week with In Translation, a Gin episode.
Yes, Dave, it is In Translation, episode 17 of season 1, directed by Tucker Gates, written by Javier Grigio Marswatch. I think that, yeah, okay. And Leonard Dick. This aired on February 23rd, 2005, and it takes place on days 32 through 34 on the island. In flashbacks, we meet Sun's father. He's not great, I guess is the way to sum him up. We also learned that Jin was a real softy romantic type back in the day. He brought her flowers. He said that she was his dream. He was very much in love with Sun. We then later learned that Jin also used to punch government officials repeatedly in the face, and that was his job. So sort of a rough time there.
Diamond in the rough.
Yeah. And then we also learned that Jin had also planned to escape their life in Korea by taking Sun away from her father once they got to LA and he delivered these watches. So it's very tragic how they almost left. One of them almost left and the other one was going to, oh God, it's just a mess. It turns me into a mess every time. On the island, Shannon and Saeed talk about tying knots. Saeed, Shannon, and Boone have a bunch of drama about how close Shannon and Saeed are getting. And then Locke gets involved and gives Shannon a really weird slash effective pep talk. Elsewhere on the island, someone sets the raft on fire, which is very disappointing because Michael was using all of his construction skills and getting it done very quickly. Michael and Sawyer blame Jin because of an altercation they had earlier on the beach. Michael and Jin start fighting. It all ends when Sun starts speaking English in front of everyone, which causes Jin to stop speaking to her and to move out of the cave, which, you know, also sad. John Locke gives a big speech about not being alone on the island, about how the others probably are the ones who burned down the raft, something that we learn is not true a couple minutes later. Toward the end here, Saeed and Shannon make up. John and Walt play backgammon and talk about how Walt totally burned the raft down. And then Jin is also now helping Michael rebuild the raft. It ends with perhaps the most delightful Hurley CD player-related ending, in which everyone is sort of living their new island lives, and everyone seems kind of happy, and then Hurley's CD player dies. And then it's just like a lovely quiet. It's great. Something to remember for next week. Next week's episode is called Numbers. Jin in the flashback, Jin punches the government official guy 8 times. Just, you know.
Oh, ho, ho, ho.
Exactly. This all leads me to this week's opening question. Which dog would you rather have, Vincent or Sun's champion breed, Sharpei, Dave? Which dog would you... I guess which dog would you steal? Because they're both stolen.
Yeah, that's a good point. If I were to be it cohabiting with my partner still, I'd have to go with Vincent, because I believe that's a much, you know, friendlier, more aesthetically pleasing dog breed. If it's just me by myself, I'm taking that Sharpei, because I'd call him like Wrinkles or something, and it would be like much more entertaining to me, who, you know, is mostly okay learning how to take care of a new dog breed, to, you know, fool around with that little Sharpei dude.
Joanna, do you think either one of these dogs would play well with your cat?
Well, no, but I would take the Sharpei, and here's why. Fun fact trivia of this episode. So this episode, obviously, right, is a mirror of House of the Rising Sun. And, I don't know. I don't presume to know what they knew and when they knew it or whatever. But, in this episode, we see Jin take the Sharpei when it's a puppy. And then the next time we see it, which is like the next day-ish. Soon, it is a full-grown ass dog. So I'm taking the Sharpei because it's obviously magic. So magic Sharpei, nice, is what I'm taking. Yes.
Yeah. I think I would take the Sharpei just because of his cute wrinkly face.
I mean, my awkward preamble is, I think in House of the Rising Sun, they didn't know yet sort of like what the significance would need to be of the puppy and the puppy timeline and stuff like that, do you know? So, right. It was okay that it was like a puppy when he first gave it to Sun. And then later when we see her waiting for him, it's a full grown dog. But when we see in the context of the episode that it all revolves around the same job that he's doing for her dad, that dog had a growth spurt, quite the growth spurt. So
the magic Sharpei.
Yeah. Magic Sharpei.
Cool.
I wonder somehow if it was also like, well, could he just steal like a full-grown Sharpei from a little girl? And someone's like, well, that's not sad enough. He has to take the puppy from the little girl.
Well, I don't know. Is it sadder that this little girl's like relatively new dog has been taken away, or like a dog she's grown up with her whole like 6 or 7 years on the earth?
Fair enough. That little girl's like just having not a great week on Lost.
Yeah. I don't know. She was watching. She got to watch some. That sounds really fun to me. So if I'm a kid, I love news reports on the lottery. So.
Nothing. The only thing that would make this day any better is if my dad got punched in the face 8 times.
Exactly 8 times.
Exactly 8 times. All right. In translation, this episode, another good Lost episode, I think, because I like a good island mystery. And this isn't treated so much as a mystery as it is sort of like a thriller of Jin, who is having his own crisis where he thinks that his wife is maybe taking a little too kindly to Michael, specifically if not exposing herself to everybody maybe too much on the island. Meanwhile, Walt decides this is time that to stop this raft right now, now that he knows that it's going to be him and his father and Sawyer and at least one other person on this rapidly assembled raft, burns it down and sets this whole conflict ablaze with the raft itself. Let's start with Joanna. Joanna, flashback story, island story, which one do you prefer if you had to split the two?
It's tough because this is such an important flashback. It's the only flashback story, I think, where we see the same thing from, no, but it's the only one like all the way through where we're seeing the same story from a different point of view. You know?
Right, and it makes it like revelatory once you realize that's going to happen or is happening.
So, like on rewatch, I'm not like it's not the most compelling backstory I've ever seen in my life. Especially since I'm not sure it really smooths over like how extremely controlling Jin was in the first few episodes. But for as like the way it functions as plot and character reveal, I think makes the flashback weighs the flashback heavier.
Yeah, I think it works really well to actually soften Jin, because you're right in the sense that early on his island, or at least we weren't sure if it, his island, behavior was more of a cultural thing or more of a, I'm an abusive husband thing. And you go into this episode realizing it's going to be a him flashback. And then like halfway through, you realize that he's innocent enough to not realize what, like, send this man a message that I'm very displeased is, to the point where he, like, gets this dog foisted on him and, you know, has to interrupt his dinner date. It all really works for me in a classic Lost parable about how bad fathers can poison relationships from both sides. Well, I guess Jin's father isn't bad at all, but Jin's bad relationship with his father or his shame around his typical fisherman father sort of poisons or leads him to sort of denying part of himself. I don't know. Neil, what's your read on flashback Jin in this episode?
Oh, there's a lot of daddy issues here, Dave, I think. Because, you know, and it's interesting that they sort of waited to this. This is the first time we see we interact with Sun's father, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So it's interesting that they waited this long to have someone interact with Sun's father, who is such a sort of overwhelming force, especially in that first episode where he's sort of this looming thing. And this episode is really, the flashbacks are about Jin working out his issues with both Sun's father and his own. So yeah, this is like daddy issues squared for Jin. But I do like how it complements the story that they end up telling on the island. Because there's a lot of like larger story elements that are accelerating here as we sort of get in the home stretch of, season one, stuff like the raft, and John Locke's sort of interest in being on the island. You know, like his interest in staying, which is sort of what draws him to Walt at the end of this episode. So they were able to move a lot of stuff along and also sort of keep the island's focus on Jin and Sun and their relationship. And then we get this just really excellent climax where Sun is outs herself as being able to speak English in front of everyone. You know, and good. I will say this. Good on Kate for just being like, oh, Sun, why didn't you tell any? Like, just giving her this look, even though she fucking knew. So, just, you know. Something Kate, I noticed on my rewatch.
Kate plays it off to her
like
advantage.
Kate being like, oh, how dare she?
That made me crazy because she like doesn't comfort. So everyone walks away. So you get the shot of Sun being upset. And I'm like, Kate.
Right. And they specifically hold on Kate as she walks away.
Stick around. Remember how Jack left you crying in the cave. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you just like, you get a lot of wonderful character moments. You know, the Sun and Jin argument on the island at the end is just incredible stuff from these two actors who, even though we've already gotten a Sun episode, Sun and Jin sort of exist at that second level in that periphery around sort of what we consider to be the main storyline characters of the show. So it's good to really give them some room to do some good acting.
Can I ask you guys a question that apparently is still hotly debated among Lost fans?
Sure.
There's this point when Sun is like yelling at Jin on the beach there, yelling / pleading or what have you. And she's doing it in Korean and then she switches to English. He walks across the camera frame. Like his full body goes across the camera frame. And then she's in English saying, I was going to leave you. You made me believe you loved me, blah, blah, blah. And then she switches back to Korean. Now, some people think that is similar to the technique they use with Saeed, where like in Saeed's episode where he switches from, not speaking English to speaking English, but like we're supposed to understand that he's still speaking, not English. Do you know what I mean? So that right. Nathan Andrews didn't have to keep awkwardly fumbling a language. Do you think she's speaking English here? Do you think she's speaking Korean here? If she's speaking English, what do you make of this idea that like she confesses, I was going to leave you, but she does it in a language that Jin doesn't understand? She does it almost for like the benefit or is it that she felt almost brave enough to confess to him, but not quite? Or what do you make of it, Dave?
I like how that scene plays out dramatically because it also has a flashback that, you know, comes before Jin delivers his answer to sort of contextualize it, after Sun, you know, basically has the language switching monologue. I'm not sure if I stopped to think about it no, I definitely did. And in the moment, how I felt, I have to justify this as I go along, is she is speaking in English, a language she doesn't understand, but because of how she's saying it and when she's saying it, Jin like gets it. Like Jin's not dumb. He knew that was one of the options for why she would learn English and not tell him, and probably was assuming it anyway. So him not understanding the actual word for word doesn't bother me too much until you brought it up.
Neil.
Yeah, I agree. I always read that as he understands enough to understand that she's telling him about something that she almost did to him. Like, you know, it's like he understands the sentiment that she's laying down. That's the okay. That part is not lost in the translation.
Yeah, that's the name of the episode.
Yeah, although it is, I mean, it's interesting because they did do that thing. Although the fact that she switches back to Korean is what makes me believe that she really was speaking English.
Because
if they did that language switch thing again, there's nobody speaking Arabic anymore in Lost.
Right.
That was the last of it total.
That's not true.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Wait, what? Is it?
I don't think that's true. We'll see.
Well, that's the last we've seen since then.
Since then, yes.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Also, that was very deliberate, and this episode is very, I think, well shot from the perspective of Jin when it is about the confusion of, you know, not understanding a very threatening Sawyer, or we have a close-up that, like, threatens to, but never includes, like, his actual eyes, because we're trying to focus on the lips with Jin, to the reverse dialogue on the beach, which I think definitely puts us there in time for us to have the big showdown between Jin and Michael. But because they're so purposeful with those specific things, I think if it was a storytelling device, we would have seen something to give us a hint that it was a narrating change and not a actual change in language.
Something I learned while doing some research on this episode is that apparently a very popular theory in season one of Lost was that Jin could also speak English and was like lying about it. And that this was the first, like, because they did that backwards, you know, they just reversed the dialogue, as Dave said, like they do in Twin Peaks to make everything sound creepy. That was confirmation that Jin, in fact, did not speak English. So that's a theory that at the time I probably would not have ascribed to. I would have been like, guys, it's bad writing to have both your husband and wife team, like, pretending they couldn't speak English and they could. But, you know, bad. Turns out 2004/2005 had some bad fan theories as well. So there you go.
Well, and especially now, it's so little to go on. We just got the other half to the Sun story. I think we're finally getting into the.
Well, I'm just saying, if during season one, if they're like watching an episode where Jin's talking to someone and doesn't seem to understand, but there are some fans who'd be like, no, I think he actually does understand. You know what I mean? Like, I can definitely see that being a theory. Do you know?
Oh yeah.
What I mean.
Well, I was just going to say, we're just getting to the point, I think, where Lost is going to start encouraging, you know, fans to have theories, in the sense that these back nine episodes not only ramp up some of the more science fiction-y elements and the conflict at the exact same time, but our flashbacks have just started to, like, complete... unwrap mystery boxes that have been set previously in the episode
and get some,
or in the series.
Get some chocolate in the peanut butter, like, as in Hurley's in this flashback, and we had Christian in last week's flashback.
It was the other side of Suns versus, like, Christian, like, giving more context to Sawyer and Jack last week. It's all starting to fold in on itself in a great way.
Yeah, I think this episode... and we'll talk about this a bit more in the storm section, but this episode really drives home for me the way that the back nine of this first season, like, they really knew what they were going to do for the rest of the year. And so we're seeding stuff in a more confident way, if that makes any sense. So, can I do a bad dad check-in, sort of hopping off something Neil said earlier?
Yes.
Let's.
Bad dad. Son's dad. Bad dad?
Yes. Bad dad.
Yes.
Okay. Jin's dad. Good dad?
Yes.
Yeah, I would go with good. He did the best with what he had.
I think he's maybe the only good dad we've seen so far until Walt's dad. Good dad, bad dad in this episode.
Oh, this Michael. Episode?
Yeah, Michael.
Just limited to this episode or overall?
This episode.
Bad dad.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to say good dad.
Yeah.
And the fact that Michael has started to become a good dad lately might have been why the raft got burned down. Because part of Walt's calculation is like, oh, wait, being here isn't so bad. And, like, I just connected with my dad. Like, I don't want to go die on the ocean instead of hanging out with my dad.
He's not annoyingly bad, like, not letting Walt take his golf turn previously in the series. But should you really beat another guy almost to death in front of your kid, like, on the beach... and like the doctor's yelling like stop this, and Sawyer's like it's between them, and then be like, yes, this is the way justice works.
Can I just say
in
really
front of my child,
before we get back to the bad dad check-in, can I just say one I had to go rewatch this because in House of the Rising Sun there's another Michael and Jin fight, right? This time Jin has the upper hand when they're fighting in the surf. Mm-hmm. And Saeed and Sawyer literally come running across the beach, and Saeed jump tackles Jin to get him off of Michael. And in this episode, both of them are like, not our fight, bro. Let them fight. I was like,
well,
where?
Like, a lot's what? Happened since then.
I guess so. But I guess it's Lord of the Flies now down on the beach. But I was like, oh, this is very different from how Saeed felt about people fighting before. All right. So, I will just weigh in quickly on Michael, good dad or bad dad. I like this episode for showing us a continuation of that Michael Walt dynamic when, you know, they're talking at the end of their episode. I feel like when he's talking to him about the Flatiron building and all that sort of stuff, it just shows us like a bit more of Michael trying to connect with his son. I have a last question for you, and you have to confine it to things we learned in this episode. Locke's dad, good dad, bad dad. Dave?
Indeterminate. You can't trust anything Locke says.
Neil?
I think the vibe that Locke is giving off about his dad is not great.
I agree.
In this episode. So I don't think we know, obviously we don't know the extent of it, but Locke does not seem to be a fan.
Yes. I would say if we're rounding up the bad dads, what we learned in this episode is that Locke's dad might belong in that category. So, there you go.
It is a Damon Lindelof series.
So many dad issues.
And also, yeah, like to go back to the fight and whether or not we interfere or not, it should be noticed that, you know, I give Jack a hard time a lot of the time and I like question his leadership a lot. In this episode, he's right the whole time. So let's give Jack credit. Like every time he's like, we don't know it's Jin. Let's calm down. We don't know it's Jin. Let's break up this fight. We don't know it's Jin. And so like that, the Jack is the only one showing like seemingly correct instincts around that, right? But something else that you notice really obviously in this episode is he's still got that the Halliburton key tied so like ostentatiously around his neck, and I really it feels like really vulgar, flashy, I'm in charge accessory, right? I've got the keys to the
he's
gun
flaunting
right
his
here.
Gun key.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's the time where he comes up to Michael and he's like, people are starting to talk about who else is getting on this boat, which they then don't use as like another way to be like, maybe Jin didn't burn down this boat. Like there were other people. There was a lot of talk about jealousy or maybe jockeying for this last spot. It's sort of abandoned once, you know, we realize Sawyer is there and, you know, Sawyer's going to be on the boat. In this episode, it seems like the main reason for having Sawyer being the one to be on the boat is to piss off Jack, and so he couldn't be a suspect, because in any other situation, if something goes wrong, Sawyer's been the first suspect, not completely left out of the discussion.
That's a good point. It's a very good point. The other thing, though, to notice in terms of like keys and locks and accessories is that Jin still has his handcuff. Poor Jin still has that handcuff on. From like 13 episodes ago, something like that. So, you know, it's probably getting real, real chafed, over there. So.
Yeah. I think they might have run out of moisturizer a while ago.
They ran out of deodorant like 4 episodes ago.
Well, maybe we don't know how much the last of the deodorant was. Mm. Maybe there's one person who's very good at golf, and they definitely ran out of golf balls by this point.
I also thought that the difference between Locke and Jack in this episode is really interesting to me. Because, as you guys discussed, the Jack is sort of... he's correct and probably best in like the moment under pressure, but he's not thinking strategically. I do love that Locke shows up and is like, it's the other people on the island. We need to mobilize. He has got his agenda out there now.
That seemed like a very obvious conclusion Much like, you know, Sawyer would have been had he not had a vested interest in the raft. But I am surprised that, you know, everybody, not especially Walt, but including Walt, let it get that far without being like, there are other people. Like, Claire and Charlie are there. You would think that would be on the forefront of their minds, that there are still, you know, other people out in the forest that it probably at least have fire. I don't know. Ethan looked like he occasionally washed his clothes.
Against a rock. I wanted to talk about a couple things. Oh, really quickly, are we going to talk about... So there's something, this is not a spoiler, I think, to even mention that they exist, but there's something called the Lost Mobisodes, which they released between, I think it's season 3 and 4. Is that right?
Yes, although I think it's called Mobisodes because they were mobile.
Mobile, sorry. I always say Mobisodes in my head. Mobisodes or Webisodes. There's two Mobisodes. I would not recommend, if you're watching Lost for the first time, that you go seek out all of them. They're called The Missing Pieces, and they fill in scenes, in between scenes from earlier in the show. There are some that will be spoilers for you, so I don't recommend you go and watch them all, but there are some that take place right around this time. Do we want to discuss them? Or
if you think they are not spoilers...
I mean, they're considered canon, so...
Right, but it's not like character X was secretly watching through the trees. It's like two characters have... let's... Shoot a trial balloon Mobisode at me. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think
this could be a whole bunch of beeps.
Idea.
Here we go. But let's see.
There is one where Sun is trying to bury her California driver's license that she has acquired shallowly in the island dirt so that Jin won't find it. And Michael comes upon her. He's looking for Vincent. And they almost kiss. And then Vincent comes running up, is like the only reason why they don't, and then they part ways.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I don't know if
obviously Jin thinks that there's possibilities that Sun and Michael have a thing, right? Like, cause he's in his like jealous rage mindset, but I never read anything about Sun and Michael as romantic.
I always read it as that was the direction they were going to go and then decided not to, because same with like Saeed and Kate, like that you could see how they like started laying track there and then they were like, but maybe not, you know?
And do you think that's because, you know, I think it's very clear that the show, as it shows us more about these characters, it wants us to think more complexly about them. And I think ultimately it wants us to be on everyone's side. You know, like they're using these flashbacks to sort of break down Jin so that we like Jin, even though he's not great all the time. But I think, I don't know, if Sun shows up on the island and then gets a dude on the side, that doesn't make Sun a very... nice person, I guess.
I like the idea.
It's not great
of this
for Michael
being,
either.
No.
Yeah, I like the idea of it being a Mobisode, because it's not something that I like can't imagine happening at this time in the story world. Like, we did have, you know, a couple of like awkward moments that, at least in the episodes, the way they've been cut in so far, have just played as like awkward moments that could be viewed externally as like mildly sexual. But that being said, as Neil has reminded us, it only takes like 7 days before you start thinking weird sexual thoughts on an island with a whole bunch of adults. So did they almost kiss at some point in the timeline, maybe around here? Sure. Do I think there's ever a good time in the story to be like, oh yeah, and they almost kissed once, but they never went anywhere? I don't think so at all. So I'm fine with it existing on the Mobisode, but if you were to like throw it in at the beginning of this episode, then I'm like, that's almost too much. Michael's being too much of an asshole.
Yeah, it's almost it's almost better that Jin is like incorrect, because it just speaks to his isolation, you know what I mean? Like, he's got conspiracy theories because he can't like understand what's going on around him because he doesn't speak the language. And that brings me to the second Mobisode. Can I talk about this one? Mm-hmm. Yes. This one also takes place around this time. Actually, maybe if we're being honest, maybe like right after this episode. But like immediately after this episode. And it is Jin and Hurley and Michael in the golf course. And Jin takes a shot and misses it. I only say after because like Jin and Michael seem like somewhat relaxed around each other as opposed to like wanting to fight each other, right? So Jin takes a shot and he misses it, and then he loses his shit and just starts yelling about how much he hates the island and all he wanted was one moment of joy to make his shot. And Michael's like, should we do something? And Hurley's like, let him get it out. And he's just like freaking out. And then he goes like, I'm so lonely, because like he doesn't understand what anyone's saying. I know, it's funny and sad. So that one I think is called Jin Has a Temper Tantrum on the Golf Course. The Sun and Michael one is called Buried Secrets. That's number 8 Mobisode and number 11 Mobisode. So if you want to watch those, I think, you know, and these are like directed by Jack Bender. The Temper Tantrum one was written by Drew Goddard, and the Buried Secret one was written by Christina Kim. So, anyway, if you want to watch those, they're all on YouTube. You can find them. Those are the non-spoiler ones that you can't watch. But yeah, I like that sort of I'm so lonely, because I feel like we know that about Jin. Like, we can kind of figure it out by some of like his silent glances and stuff like that, but like we don't know it. So,
Yeah, and he has a flashback where he doesn't really interact with anybody else friendly. Like, at least Sun had woman that was helping get her out and various machinations. Her English teacher.
I guess there's his dad.
Oh, he has a dad eventually, yeah. But he spends most of his, you know, adult life that we see being ashamed of his dad and being slowly forced into a life of crime.
Can I? Sorry, after that review, I'm like wary of talking too much. Can I, did you guys look up the translation for like the non-subtitled Korean in this episode?
No.
Okay, so there's, I don't know why it's called this, but there's a website called patriotresource.com/lost/insights/Korean, which has all the, Korean, the non-subtitled Korean. Translated. And I find it really interesting, this the part at the end where he's been dragged in front of Michael and he's sort of like talking to his son, and then he's talking to Michael and they're like asking son what he's saying. And it's really sad, because he says to son, you don't believe me either. That's sad. And then you see him sort of yelling at Michael, and it seems almost like he's like taunting Michael. Like, mm-hmm. It's, you know, like as Michael's like beating on him, it seems like he's saying like talking a shit to him. But instead he says, I didn't do it. I didn't start the fire. Do you understand? When I reached the boat, it was already unfired. I tried to stop the fire. That's what happened to my hands. So like, we kind of get that from like Sun, like eventually translates or whatever, but like, he's never, like, there's a part where he's just sort of like, Daniel Day Kim is delivering it like he's sort of sneering at Michael.
Yeah, it's like he's antagonizing it intentionally. Yeah.
But he's saying, he's quoting Billy Joel lyrics that, you know? So it's interesting. Anyway, you can check those out at, you know, good old thepatriotresource.com. Once again, I don't know why it's called that.
Yeah. Good old the Patriot. Well, because, you know, all patriots need their resources. You're really, it's the people who call themselves patriots that you should be wary of. Or be the best version of that you see fit and whatever. I don't know. Who knows? Let's not get into it. Let's instead talk about love being in the air between two of our losties who have found each other over a love of translating French and maps, and in this episode, tying knots.
Shibari!
Shannon has apparently learned how to tie knots because she knows lots of dudes with boats,
sure.
Which becomes a very cute little moment between her and Saeed that kicks off Saeed to go to Boone and announce his intentions. and Boone having recently detoxed from Shannon, much like Charlie detoxed from heroin, has some words of warning. And then who should Shannon turn to get a pep talk except Locke, who I think very gently adds another person to Team Locke this week by telling Shannon to start her new life.
Sort of.
To start writing on that blank slate.
What I love about this scene with Locke and Shannon is that he's also advancing his Boone-related agenda by like pointing out that Boone is still, because you said that Boone has detoxed himself, not entirely from Shannon. Like, he still sticks his nose in it with Saeed. Like, he still is like, oh, bud, this is going to go badly. And, you know, sorry in advance. He didn't have to do that. And I think Locke is right when he tells Shannon that Boone was just looking for her attention. And it's another one of those crafty Locke moves.
Which has, yeah, it has like nine.
Right. It's like you see what he's doing for Shannon, but yeah. It's also, he's like, he's doing it because he wants to continue his hold on Boone. And he wants to continue for people to think he's the leader, so that when he says we need to organize ourselves against the others, people listen next time, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, it's a good moment. Should I be writing this down? It's good. It's a good Locke moment. All Locke scenes are good scenes in these back nine, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's several really good ones in the last couple weeks here.
When a former guest on the show who was here for the Boone episode, Carolyn Framke, she got to this episode. She got really excited about Saeed and Shannon flirting. And I told her, and I don't take this back, and this isn't an insult into any sexiness that happens later on the show, but I think Shannon suggesting that she and Saeed get some rope and just hang out, just the two of them later, is the sexiest thing that happens on Lost. Full stop. That's it.
It's the high point of the island flirt game.
That's some good stuff, right there, I think. You know, not to knock anything else that happens. I'm just saying. That's, you know, maybe we should get some rope, spend our Saturday night alone together and see what happens. Good girl, Shannon. Good girl.
She's not a subtle character. Nor do I think that she has a lot of...
Listen, it's an island.
Subtextual layers.
She's living her new life.
Subtlety is overrated.
There was a period of time where Saeed's trying to talk himself or talk her out of pursuing him because he's talked to Boone and she's hanging a tarp. And the entire time I'm just looking at where she's putting that rope through that tarp and seeing it like rips. And I'm like, one gust of wind. And that tarp's going to rip off that rope. And Shannon, this is dumb. It's a dumb way to build a shelter. So I was obviously very engaged in the romance at hand.
Don't worry, Dave. They have so many more tarps.
I'm not a huge, like, Shannon and Saeed fan. I just think that that's a particularly good, like, thing to say. Come on. Not jokes. All right. Anyway.
No, Shannon's got game. She would not have made it this far if she didn't have some game.
Speaking of romance, something that I found interesting when I was doing some research on this episode is that in the final shot of the episode, not to like zoom too far ahead, I'm not saying we need to be done, but the final part is from Hurley's perspective, right? Everything we see is what Hurley's looking at, which makes the sudden thing like slightly pervy. But... Instead of like just liberating, it's liberating plus pervy. Well, something that a lot of people I saw say was that they think him looking at Claire and Charlie is him being forlorn because like he liked Claire and Claire obviously likes Charlie. That's never been my interpretation of Hurley's interaction with Claire, even though like he's the first person to sort of interact with her. He like gives her two meals and like, you know, so like, you know, and she's a cutie. So like maybe, but it's just not something that I never thought of Charlie, Claire, Hurley as any kind of love triangle. If anything, I would say maybe I'll give you like he's forlorn because his like bud is busy hanging out and romancing the girl and he's not hanging out, like, he's got no one to hang out with. You know what I mean?
He's forlorn because he made a mix CD of sad ass songs.
You think that was a mix? You don't think he travels with Damien Rice's O? or foraged Damien Rice's O, that album out of someone else's luggage?
I mean, I assumed it's like a CDR that he made to like listen to on the plane because he's sad about his life. And he just like crashed and he's like, damn, because we don't see like a book of CDs. Do we see a book of CDs?
I mean,
I know
not
we
in
do in Wrecked, the TBS comedy based on Lost.
Someone was pointing out,
sell you guys on.
Someone was pointing out that it's 2004 and wouldn't he have an MP3 player of some kind? Like a, what are they called? A Zune?
Listen, as we're finding out, Hurley is just a simple man. So don't worry about that.
Okay. Yeah. Should we talk about the
that's
music cue at the end of this episode? That's just like one of the best things that happens on Lost.
Yes.
One of our listeners was just in our Patreon Slack being like, man, how long are those batteries going to last in Hurley's disc, man? It's really fun whenever they do something like that and everyone gets like real quiet around them. Oh, I don't know how long those batteries are going to last. Anyway. They're gone now.
How many days? 34 days? 34 days on the island?
Yeah, that's not so bad. A couple of double A's.
We don't know how long, if he foraged some, you know, you never know what's been foraged off of dead people. Remember, Saeed gave Shannon some dead lady's shoes. So anything is possible.
Well, I like that we've reached a point in Lost where there's enough mystery and interpersonal drama that we could live in a world where there are no more batteries, but we're going to have a second raft built out of whatever, I guess. I guess they just used like
bamboo,
the A grade material for the first one, and now they're going to do a B grade bamboo material one.
I mean, listen,
with no salvaged fuselage parts.
I feel like you're underestimating how much Michael used to work in construction.
And how now he has a fisherman's son on his team.
Right. So now it's the artist, the construction guy, and the fisherman's son together making a boat.
Yeah.
With their, a child who has indeterminable superpowers.
And Sawyer offering up whatever he has scrolled away.
And Sawyer has some rope.
If they're smart, they'll put Sawyer on overnight, don't burn down the raft duty.
No, put Boone on that job. He'll be fine. He'll definitely stay awake and watch that raft.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question. It would seem like, from the conversation between Locke and Walt over a backgammon game, that Team Raft, whoever's on Team Raft, is actually against Team Stay on the Island. So I don't know who would necessarily be friends with Team Rebuild the Raft.
I think we can't necessarily talk about any of this.
Well, you could. Fine.
But you know what go ahead.
It is really interesting because we've discussed that Locke has not made it very. It's not a secret that Locke is super cool on the island. But I think the Walt thing can be a bit of a surprise. Like, I would imagine that folks are just watching this for the first time. I remember the Walt thing, like, learning that Walt was the one who burned down the raft was like, whoa, like, I didn't really see that coming from Walt. But you kind of understand. And like I said, like, he's seems to be enjoying his time on the island with his dad. And I think the last thing he wants to do is leave. You know, also maybe he has some sort of magnetism. Who knows?
Well, it's like, sometimes television shows, especially network television shows, kind of tip their hands to twists that are supposed to happen like that. So they make sure that you like believe it and get it. And here it's a very light touch. So like when the raft's burning down, you know, Walt tries to throw water on it eventually. And yeah, it's slightly later than everybody else, but you don't know when he arrives at the circle. And then when, like we were saying before, when Michael's beating the shit out of Jin, they don't have like cutaways to Walt looking extremely guilty. So they're not like leading their hand enough to that. I do think it comes as a surprise There isn't a lot of on-screen evidence to even make you suspect Walt. So much so that when, you know, Locke gives his big The Others speech, it seemed like, of course there was answer, as well as, you know, a masterful playing of people's fears and us versus them, to deflect conflict within. So, yeah, I think Walt was surprised. But now that we know he is, I don't know. I start taking everybody who Locke smiles at as Team Locke, but I don't think that applies to Sawyer, who got smiled at last episode. So we won't have to deal with that anymore. I just think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that we've got Walt on like some sort of mystical island side, and more so from a plot base, because I can't imagine being a child and being like, this life is great. I don't want to move. I just want to play catch with my dog every day for the rest of my life. Like, it's an island, Walt. Surely this child had books and video games growing up. But yeah.
I don't know. Anyway. He was shuffled around. He got ignored by, like, maybe possibly ignored by his mom, definitely ignored by Brian. And, like, here he gets, like, a lot of attention. A lot of people are like, you know, Locke wants to teach him how to throw knives. He used to run around, climb trees, do fun stuff. Polar bears are there. It's a cool island. I get it.
I guess it's just not a lot of forethought. But then again, if you're a crash survivor, the number one question you're asked as a kid is probably not what do you want to be when you grow up. So I guess he has some blinders put on by the particular situation.
Well, and I think it's also interesting, too, to think about the characters in the juxtaposition of, like, the Shannon storyline in this and Walt's storyline in this episode are very interesting because, you know, Shannon has now been converted and we've seen a couple of characters sort of get in this mindset where it's like, oh, you can have your life is starting over because you're on the island. And we see Walt buy into that as well. The only problem is that Walt is that sort of working against what Michael, like, it's almost like they're breaking into team fight and team flight. And Michael is very much the leader of team flight, like get off the island. But you can see a lot of the other characters starting to, you know, especially by the end of this episode, starting to enjoy this whole new start that the island is giving them, at least on an emotional level. I don't know. It's probably not, they're probably not enjoying the smell, but on an emotional level, they seem like, you know, like Shannon, seems like she's in a better place at the end of this because she realizes that she gets to do whatever she wants on the island and who she was before doesn't matter at all, you know, stuff like
she's
that.
She's like, you have no power over me.
Right. And Walt is, and Michael's like, I want to go back to my life because I had this whole plan, I guess, new plan to be with his son. And his son's like, actually, Dad, we could just make camp and we'd be good.
I think you're, to circle back really quickly, I think you're right that, like, the reveal of Walt being the one to burn the raft is a good one. Just because, like, Locke, I feel like Locke says it so casually. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons why.
It also happens really quickly. Which
yeah,
I
it's
like.
Just sort like, of like, it's like,
wrapped up a couple minutes later.
Yeah. It's just sort of like, what? He's like, hey, Walt, so why'd you burn down the raft? And you're like, what? I thought for Walt, sure it was like Ethan or something. Come on, you know?
And so. I love Malcolm David Kelly's performance in that scene because he's just so cool. He just pauses and then just explains himself. Like, there's just, you know, Walt, some would say he's maybe gifted, maybe a little different.
Maybe special.
Maybe even special.
So here's a question. Do you think, because in the beginning fire scene, we only see Locke, he's just standing there looking at it, like, kind of shocked. Do you think he was just standing there the whole time?
Maybe.
Just like,
I mean, I think I
being
like
creepy Locke hanging out in the jungle, just watching people do things.
As someone who enjoys every moment we get to spend with John Locke, because yeah. He's great.
He is great.
I like the idea that he figured it out. You know, with that, like, I like the idea that he didn't, like, see Walt do it. He just sort of figures it out. So I guess I choose to believe that, no, he wasn't standing there the whole time, but it would also be a very John Locke thing to also be standing there.
Follow-up theory. What if Locke played backgammon with, like, everyone on the island? He sits down, he's like, so Shannon, why'd you burn the raft? She's like, okay, cool. So Kate, why'd you burn the raft?
Why'd you burn the raft?
Until he got to Walt. Anyway, just thought that that was.
And then there's a mobisode of him asking Claire why she burned the raft.
Yeah. It's
Claire, why'd you burn the raft?
Do you even remember why you burned the raft?
Oh, yeah, Claire still has amnesia. All right. So can I talk about two quick parallels? One that I think is cool, one that I have some questions about.
Yes. Sure.
Number one is the gin hand parallel. Like in the flashback, his bloody hands sort of incriminate him, but actually, like, he wasn't doing a bad thing, you know, and then this one, his burn hands incriminate him, but he wasn't doing the bad thing.
He punched a guy in the face 8 times.
To save him from getting killed.
Yeah, that moment has been recontextualized now. Now you feel,
I guess, like, but if you're on Sun's side of that situation, which we have been, we see him cleaning up in the sink. What's the worst assumption you can make?
Absolutely, but if you're in Sun's position, you and the raft is burned, and your husband shows up with burned hands, what's the worst assumption you can make? Like, that's definitely the thing. Is like, yeah, it definitely does look like Jin burned the raft. His hands are burned, and the raft is burned. Well, like, who else would it be? And similarly, yeah, I'm not like saying Sun is bad for having that assumption. I'm just saying, like, he didn't do the thing, and not like it's slightly different in that, like, he could have told her the truth, and he does to a certain extent, but not really. Like, he doesn't tell her, he's like, this is the price of working for your father, like, whatever, which is true, but he could also just be like, babe, he's doing this like stoic thing, but he could have been like, babe, I had the worst fucking night. Your dad sent me to go do this thing, and then I had to, like, punch a guy 8 times in front of his daughter in order to save this other real creepy guy from killing him. So, you know. Isn't that the implication? That, like, the other guy was going to fully kill him? And so...
Yeah.
Yes, yes. That's usually what happens when you screw a silencer on you again.
So, and, like, maybe the little girl, too. And so Jin punched him 8 times for the greater good. I don't know. The other thing is that I think is like really interesting and weird, and I don't know what to make of it, is this parallel shot of, the little girl in white with her hair back and barrettes, with her little like puppy sitting next to her on the couch. And you get a near identical shot of Sun later all in white with her hair back and barrettes with the dog sitting next to her on the couch. It's like very close shot to shot.
Oh, that makes sense to me.
How does that make sense to you?
Because both Sun and the little girl, like, probably have a vague idea of what their fathers are up to, but have no actual idea of, like, what their fathers are up to. Like, it's the same, not the same trauma, but a similar sort of trauma.
Okay. Neil, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think it's that, and it also, I guess they're trying to paint this picture of Sun a little bit when she was young, being a little bit more naive about maybe what her father was doing. You know, it's this whole like Jin coming home with blood on his hands thing seems to be more of a surprise to Sun than I would have expected if she really knew what her father's like business was. So there's like a naivete. There's like a breaking point where Sun sort of learns about all these terrible things that her husband and father are doing together. And it's sort of, that's the breaking of her innocence of her relationship with these two men. I think it's super interesting that like Sun's experience in these two situations with Jin, both the bloody hands and the burnt hands is, you know, by the time we're on the island, she's very much like she believes him, you know, and is sort of sticking up for him. It's him that's moved away. You know, whereas at first she's, you know, obviously very confused as to what's going on. But I think, yeah, I mean, maybe it's just a parallel about like Sun being sort of like a child before all this bad stuff started happening.
I guess I don't like, infantilizing female characters like that.
Sure. I mean, I guess
not
it's
from
weird.
You guys. I mean, from the show. Like to me, that feels like the show is infantilizing. So
it is
like
a thing that feels purposeful. Like, you know, it's like, why do that otherwise? Unless you're trying to like make a thing out of it.
Yeah, but wasn't she that little girl? Isn't it really easy to picture time in Sun's life that she was watching TV and her dad was threatening somebody or gotten threatened in the background? I don't know.
I mean, maybe. Yeah. But like I said, she doesn't seem to be as hip to what her father does. until Jin gets involved.
Yeah,
maybe. Whereas the other little girl is literally watching her dad get his face punched in.
That's true. But that's not the shot that's mirrored, right? You're talking
earlier,
Joanna,
when
you're
she
talking
has
about
the
ones on the couch with the dog.
When she has the puppy.
Yeah, I think it is like bystander innocence thing. I don't think it's infantilizing. I don't know. So far, I think Lost is especially presenting House of the Rising Sun before in translation has done like a pretty good job for me. Like outside of things that haven't aged well because it's now 2019 and that was 2004 and you need to speak to a television audience a certain way. Like I don't think they went overboard with either Sun being too strong or Jin being too abusive. I like the conflict point. It makes sense to me as people
on this series.
So far, I think.
Oh, I really disagree about Jin. I think they swerve too hard in one direction to try to like fool the audience. But like the way that he behaves in the first like half of the season towards her, I think it does not match at all with like who we find Jin to be in this episode. There's, you know, it's one thing to be like non-communicative with your wife. And I'm not mad about it. Like whatever they were trying to fool us the same way they were trying to fool us with Michael or like various other things. But like, it's one thing to, lose communication with your wife or become like hardened and traumatized by the violence you have to do for her father, like all this various stuff. But like the end of Jin's journey, like before he's getting on the plane with Sun, is this conversation with his father where he's like, he's very soft about Sun. So for him to get on this island and be like buttoning up the top button of her cardigan and stuff like that does not seem correct to me in terms of who we are later led to believe Jin is, you know.
See, I think for me, up until I know that the watch thing was like his one last gig, he was the broken guy who made the Faustian bargain and just became the attack dog and then got put on an island with a whole bunch of strangers where like people are coming out of the ocean and breaking people's arms into like jelly. That, you know, yeah, he'd be super.
But I'm saying we do know that the watch thing was his one last job.
We do now.
Yeah.
I was saying up until this point, like the only thing that had really bothered me was sort of like racial tips that had happened because the 2004 television was different than, you know, mischaracterizing them as Chinese or whatnot. I don't think like the relationship dynamics have been off, or they haven't read off it to me.
I like this episode. As you know, I love the show. I think they swung too hard on Jin in the first few episodes to make us believe he was a certain person when he's not, you know?
I think that's fair. Yes. I also have another theory about the thing we were talking about before. The visual of Sun sitting on the couch.
Uh-huh.
This is the first, maybe the first. I don't know if we've identified any of these yet, but there are times when Lost does this thing in flashbacks where they do weird things visually to characters to try and make them look younger.
Yeah.
So like, we'll see like some bad wigs. We'll see some weird haircuts. I mean, I think the most generous reading of this would be like, yeah, they were just trying to make her look younger and they did a bad job so I think that's also possible. So, keep an eye out for more terrible,
more accidental infantilizing right. by way of bad costuming.
Well, because, you're filming these flashbacks with the actors. They're not any younger.
Yeah, so. I mean, I guess I didn't mean like how they styled Sun in that shot. I just mean like paralleling the shots.
Sure.
Like, are we supposed to think of her as a little girl in this moment? And we could talk more about this in the storm section. In fact, I think we probably should. But I don't know. I just thought I think it's an interesting visual. If any of our listeners have different interpretations of why they would draw that connection, if you agree with Dave or Neil or whatever, let us know at hosts@stormpod.com.
Hosts@stormpodcast.com.
Thank you.
I was going to see if she got it.
Yeah,
she
I close. Didn't want to step on it there.
You didn't want to infantilize.
That's right. All right, I think we should probably get to our interview after a short little few words from Joanna, unless we have more to talk about in this call in translation.
Did we do the most 2004 thing?
Just really quickly, we're going to do most 2004 thing, which is, speaking of that little girl, she's watching the news. She sees Hurley on the news, right? She's watching the news. So, I don't know. Help me with the wording on that. Should it be a kid watching the news, or more accurately, a kid watching whatever's on? Feels like a 2004 thing.
Or just like the nightly news?
Yeah, the nightly news at all. Because I feel like if we were doing it now, that kid would be looking at an iPad.
Yeah, you know? No, I think a kid watching the nightly news sums up everything 2004 about that.
Okay, so a kid watching the nightly news, the concept of a Discman and batteries, and the use of Damien Rice's Delicate from the album Oh. So, Neil, is it a kid watching the news? Is it the Discman, or is it the song choice itself, Damien Rice's Delicate?
Well, I'm making my pick as I am standing in the cemetery on the island, saying goodbye to our favorite Discman who has died and left us. It is the Discman. R.I.P.
They should get Charlie's golf club shovel to bury the Discman.
Yeah, where's the scene of Charlie and Hurley burying the Discman?
Dave, what's got your vote?
I'm also going to go with the Discman because I think we were right. We were debating, like, could Hurley have had an MP3 player? He could have, but he had this Discman, which makes me think it's like a hand-me-down. It's one of the, it was the old way. It was the last gasp of physical media. 2004 seems like a good place for it. And I hope, with the way this series is structured on flashbacks, somebody else will watch the nightly news and we could bring that back for another most 2000 whatever thing.
Great. There we go.
Excellent. Do we have anything we need to know before we get to our interview?
Oh, yeah. Just to reiterate that Javi, who was so great to talk to us, as he, I think, points out, but I just want to underline, he only worked on the first two seasons of the show. He is only speaking with any kind of authority about his experience working on the first two seasons of the show. He is not trying to express any authority about, like, the later series of the show, and I just want to make that as clear as he would probably wish it to be. Also, you should check out The Dark Crystal, which airs on Netflix in its entirety on August 30th. So do that, 80s kids, and listen to our interview with Javier Grillo Markswatch. Nailed it. Not really. Thank you so much for joining us. I just want to point out, if people are listening to this and they haven't already, they should definitely go read The Last Will and Testament of Javier Grillo Markswatch, which is this piece he wrote back in 2015. And one of the reasons why he wrote this piece, as you stated in it, was to prevent anyone from asking you questions about Lost. And then I went ahead and asked you to be on my Lost podcast.
Well, a man alone can't fight the future, you know?
So, you know, a major theme of that was, you were sort of, I don't want to say defending, but sort of pushing back on this constant question of, like, how much was planned, what was planned, blah, blah, blah. I just want to let you know that is not something we're interested in here today or in general. Like, we are very, like, I will just say this really quickly. I feel like that question comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of how writing television works.
Well, you know, there's also, I mean, look, part of it is our fault too. I mean, it's like, you know, there is, you know, with every television show, any work of art really, especially a collaborative one, you know, the what I call the hagiographical narratives start early and often, you know. And I think that, you know, we certainly didn't do ourselves any favors by talking about, you know, how the show could go 5 years and how we knew how it would end and all of that stuff. You know, JJ, for example, I think made a lot of those pronouncements in the media. And I think that, you know, look, I think that there were certainly plans and discussions and things like that. But Lost, you know, we were trying to make a show that was 24 hours of show a year and not knowing when it would end. So, you know, and I think also there's a, you know, for example, if you look at how Joe Straczynski has presented his, you know, his creation of Babylon 5 as the idea that he already had the 5-year novel for television arc. And, you know, you hear people even fanwank that and say, well, yeah, but he had trapdoors set up so that when he lost Michael O'Hare, he could bring in Bruce Boxleitner. And you're like, you know, I don't know. I mean, Straczynski seems like, you know, like a methodical and rigorous enough guy that maybe he's the one dude who did it. But I think, right. although I got to tell you, I sincerely doubt it, but I'm sure the Babylon 5 fans will come after me with brickbats for saying this. I you know, but look, I think that any TV show is you know, there's a great expression that boxers use, and it is everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face, you know? And a series order is the biggest punch in the face you can get, you know? So I think that for anybody to say, I had my entire show plotted out and it's exactly how I thought about it 4 years ago, I wrote the entire structure of it in a big chief notebook and it's in a safe in a bank in Toluca Lake, that's bullshit. You know, like, it's just not true. That, right. You know, because TV doesn't work that way. You know, you're literally wrestling a giant beast that's cost a ton of money, and there's all sorts of external factors that you can't account for, you know, so. But, you know, but look, maybe that is the limit of my own imagination. Maybe I just can't imagine a great Titanic creator coming up with that. But I think the bottom line of it is that, yes, people ask that, but it's not like we didn't encourage them to ask that question. So as exasperating as it is to keep being asked that, part of it is pushback against our own sort of hagiographical narrative of, not only did we create the show, we came up with all of it, and we're just dishing it out as best we can over the course of these 24 hours, which is, you know, not the case.
I remember listening to Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan talk about this on his Breaking Bad podcast, about how they would often write themselves into narrative corners at the end of a season, not knowing how they were going to get Walter White out of this scrape. And it was sort of a writing challenge for them, you know, just to see how they could figure out what to do. And so there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe some people are better at it than others, but there's nothing wrong with not knowing exactly what you're going to do next every single time.
Well, I think great art, and, you know, whether you think Lost is great art or not is an academic question. I mean, I'm obviously taking it as read just based on its impact and what it did, but it comes out of questions. You know, it doesn't come out of having answers. You know, it comes out of exploration, and it comes out of asking a lot of questions. And I think that one of the nice things about how we made Lost is we set up a bunch of characters, we set up a bunch of situations, we had an idea of where they were going, what they might do, what they might not do, and all of that. And then we asked a lot of questions about that, you know, and we asked a lot of questions of it. And, you know, I think the person who handled this best ever was Ron Moore, you know, who basically, they asked him, well, what's the arc for Galactica? And he basically said, hey, we're pros. We know what we're doing. Trust me, I'm Ron Moore. You know, and it's one of those things where, like, you know, look, it is neither a symphony nor a jazz improv. And once you wrap your mind around that and you maybe put some trust in the writers, you might have a good ride out of it.
So when you wrote this piece back in 2015, you said that you had watched the first two seasons that you had worked on and then nothing in between. And then you circled back and you watched the finale. Is that still the case?
At the risk of tipping the hand of some of my emotions about having left the show, you can have an amicable breakup, but that doesn't mean you want to have lunch with your ex-wife every week. You know,
so we're going to start by talking about this episode in translation, which you have a co-writing credit on.
Yeah.
You, for this season, you got to write both the Sun and the Jin episode, which is a really big challenge, I think, of the first season.
Yes.
How to hold back information, how to hold back one half of a story and tell it all through the lens of a culture that maybe, you know, your average Lost audience member is unaware of.
Yeah.
So what were some of the ups and downs of doing that?
No, my complete ignorance of Korean culture, first of all, which I think is deeply manifest in my groping attempts at rendering it on the page and on film. You know, and I apologize to anybody who might have taken umbrage at any of the things we got wrong. I was terrified of writing both the episode that became House of the Rising Sun, I think is what they retitled it, and then the episode that was in translation, because, you know, I mean, it's like, you're coming at this, you've got a couple of weeks to write the script. I'm not exactly versed in Korean culture. We had a writer who was half Korean in the show and who had a very strong grasp on that. So she was extraordinarily helpful. And, that was Monica Macer, and that was great, you know, and she really sort of was able to kind of walk me through a lot of that stuff. But I had no idea what I was going to write this episode about. I mean, we broke a story and I knew the story was there, but it was just so daunting. And then, you know, the moment of epiphany that I had is that, you know, I'm Puerto Rican. English is not my first language. And I have, you know, reams of stories about how embarrassing and how mortifying and how just difficult it is to not be fully understood. You know, when I came to this country, my grasp of, you know, I had learned English in school, but my grasp of English wasn't that of somebody who used it every day to communicate. And I remember how humiliating that could be, you know, because people made fun of my accent, people made fun of my pronunciation, people made fun of the way you might malaprop words and stuff like that. And that became the hook by which I could understand Sun and Jin and their problems on this island, you know, and the idea that Sun actually spoke English and she was hiding it and all of that, you know. So there was a lot of that where the ultimate emotional connection with the characters came not out of a deep-seated understanding of Korean culture, but rather out of a real sort of empathic feeling of this is what it feels like to have people not understand you and mock you and minimize you for it, you know. And once I hit that, I knew kind of what I needed to write. And that's kind of where both those episodes, my part of them, came out of. You know, obviously in translation, I co-wrote with Leonard Dick. So, I mean, there's a lot of Leonard's work in that episode as well, obviously. So I can't take credit for all of it. But the emotional hook for me with Sun and Jin was it was very much my own immigrant experience.
A big element of these flashbacks in season one were all about these sort of surprising reveals about the character. The big one, of course, is Locke in a wheelchair, but some of the other reveals are more character-based, like Michael, we think he's a bad dad, and then we find out there are other circumstances there. And then for Jin, you know, we start, you know, having these prejudices against who we think he is and what kind of husband we think he is.
Yeah. Well, and we led you to have those prejudices. I mean, Jin is pretty much a heel you know, through most of the pilot. And then, you know, in House of the Rising Sun, you see him as sort of more of an innocent, but he's still, you know, we've said that he's done terrible things and you see how he's become that person and all that. So, you know, in translation, it was really fulfilling for me that way, because a lot of the fans, especially online, were very upset at what they perceived as a very sort of negative stereotypical portrayal in with Jin specifically. So, you know, I was very happy. Like, it was a big relief when In Translation finally came out and we could be like, whew, here you go, guys. This is what we meant. You know?
Did you ever wish that it could have been an earlier in the season reveal, like having people wait that many weeks for that info?
I mean, it's weeks, you know, like on Netflix is not that long, you know. You know, look, you think about how people consume the show one way and then you think about the afterlife it has. And ultimately, was it mortifying at the time because people thought a lot of people thought we were being bigoted? Yeah. And then, you know, I knew what was coming. And then, you know, with a little patience, by the time that House of the Rising Sun came out, we knew what we were going to do with that story. So it's not like we were just sort of making that up. So it was actually, you know, like dealing with a lot of the fans online and a lot of the backlash was just almost a question of saying, hey, hang on, you know, see how the story develops and then tell us, you know. And that became a really good tool for dealing with some of the anger that Jin's, you know, stereotypical nature in the first few episodes gave us, you know.
Yeah, and that's something that we found, too, with our first-time watchers who are watching mm-hmm. with us. We just have to be like, trust us, and just hang in there.
Exactly.
Hang in there and wait and see. And thankfully, you know, people who are listening to us, who have listened to us over the years, know that we wouldn't just sort of defend something if this were all it
sure.
were. You know what I mean? So
let's... Well, I think also there is, you know, look, people now consume television while on their phones and tablets and computers, and they live tweet or... You know, they see the show and then they have a response to it that's an immediate response, and then they go and they tweet it, and that's great. I mean, it's what the water cooler used to be, and that's fine. But I think that, you know, there's also something to taking in a piece of narrative and then letting it sit with you for a little while and then sort of making up your mind about it, especially a serialized narrative. You know there's more coming down the pike, you know.
Right, right.
So you can always afford to give it some time to find out whether these, you know, look, in most TV shows, the characters you meet in the pilot are not what they are by the end of the season, you know, just
right.
by virtue of narrative necessity. So I think, you know, patience, I think that we may get a bloated sense of the importance of that first impression based on how people consume and react to television today. But I think most people are willing to give a lot of things a chance, you know?
To that end, I know that you wrote some characters sort of tailored to the actor, like Hurley for Jorge Garcia or Sawyer mm-hmm. changing a bit for Josh Holloway.
Well, it's interesting. Josh auditioned for Sawyer. Sawyer was already sort of created. I mean, he took that part and owned it. And then once he had it, it became him. You know, it became what we saw his strengths were, because there are so many of them and they were so good. But, you know, look, Sawyer, a lot of Sawyer comes out of, you know, Damon's sort of, you know, he loves teasing people and loves coming up with names. And then that sort of became a game of coming up with, you know, ways of, you know, coming up with sort of weird nicknames for everybody that he would use and stuff like that. So, you know, but, you know, but with, for example, Jorge auditioned with Sawyer Sides, actually. So, you know, and that character was going to be sort of a schlub. And then, not a schlub, like he was going to be like a guy with a receding hairline and a pocket right, protector right. and short sleeves and a tie, you know, that kind of guy, you know, the guy who takes your order at the local Mr. Goodwrench, you know.
One phenomenon I love of serialized television writing is that, you know, an actor can show up with a whole wealth of tricks that maybe you didn't know they had. And all of a sudden the narrative, the plot sort of bends around wanting to include that character more and more.
Oh, hell yes.
I feel like there is a performer on Lost who had that sort of plot warping ability.
Well, you know, one of my, and I don't know, you know, how much of this was the actor and how much of it was sort of the evolution of it in the writing, but, you know, Terry O'Quinn had played a lot of these, you know, sort of villainous middle-aged men in his in his career. You know, he has that look, and he's also a phenomenal actor. And one of the things that we kept learning with him was that he had the physicality to be the Locke that we all had in our minds. You know, and I think a lot of Locke's sort of abilities on the field kind of came out of, you know, that sense of physicality that Terry brought to the part. You know. Not just his, you know, I mean, look, he's a guy who can bring a great sense of menace to it, and he's a great actor. So, you know, he can do pretty much anything you give him. And I think also once we saw how he was physically on the island, you know, that sort of became part of the myth of Locke, you know? So that was a big one, you know, look, obviously Hurley was a character who, you know, was not entirely baked, in the pilot, I think, you know. I mean, you know, he was there and we had some ideas for him, but he was the hardest character to come up with a backstory for. We just couldn't nail it. And I think that a lot of what Jorge did with the character, you know, even it wasn't like Jorge picked up the phone and called us and said Hurley should be this, but I think that a lot of just his interpretation of the character kind of helped us along the way of figuring out what would be the correct backstory for that guy, you know? And I think Hurley was, out of all the characters, Hurley was the most work in progress one, you know? And I think that, you know, so that, for example, is a big part of that. I think, look, ultimately every actor kind of teaches you how to write their character, even though the character is part of you rather than them. I mean, their job is to interpret the character, but at a certain point, especially when you're doing 24 hours of television, I mean, they become that person. And as a TV writer, you are remiss if you don't take what they have brought to it and put it on the page also. And that's a big part of it, you know?
You talk in this Lost Will and Testament that you wrote about how, of course, the flashbacks become an integral part of the Lost brand of storytelling, but they weren't, you know, they weren't initially intended that way.
Yeah.
The original intention was to have all of the action take place on the island, and that the idea to mirror the island action with a flashback story came very late in the process.
So late in the process. Yeah, like literally the pilot had been finished and we had the micro flashbacks in the pilot, but it wasn't something we thought would be part of the show. And that's, you know, again, you know, there's a lot of revisionist history about some of the stylistic gestures of the show, but it was a pretty late development, you know?
So then I'm curious, since these flashbacks came out of these backstories that you created just to flesh out the characters for your own purposes, what from those original backstories that you wrote for these characters were you most excited to see make it through to become an actual flashback on the show?
Well, I don't know that it had to be fought for, but, you know, I was – the reason I wound up writing the episode All the Best Cowboys Have Daddy Issues was that you know, that Jack backstory. I have a background in – my father's a physician. I've grown up around doctors, around the medical community and all of that stuff. And so it's just something – and obviously that story's not based on my dad, you know, or anything like that. But it's just something that it sort of cobbled together from a lot of things that – people and things that I knew from my own, you know, past and just the community that I grew up in and the people my father kept company with. So, you know, for that, you know, writing that story of Jack and all of that, I felt very close to it. And that was really important for me to, I was really excited that I got the chance to write that one, you know?
Yeah, of course. And is there anything that you really wanted to see come through from the original outlines and stuff like that that didn't make it?
Well, the battle dolphins, I was very, no. I mean, there's literally a time when the bay was going to be, you know, there would be cyborg dolphins that were, and we mercifully chucked that idea. I mean, along with, you know, Saeed fights a giant snake and the you know, look, it's funny. You do a show like this and, you know, the first 25 story ideas you come up with are all Star Trek. You know, everybody gets sick. Everybody gets high. Everybody's inhibitions come down. Everybody faces their greatest fear. Everybody is duplicated into an evil twin. You know, a parasite takes over one guy, you know, da da da. I mean, it's a lot of what Lost was about was taking a lot of those tropes and kind of putting them on their head a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So that by the time that her friend, it was okay to do that, you know?
Right.
And a lot of that was the pressure that we had from the network to be a more ordinary show, you know? And in that tension between us being crazy and them being sane, we found art, you know? Things that I wish I had seen, you know, I'll tell you what my biggest regret is. I really wanted to write. There was an episode that was ultimately written by Liz Sarnoff. That was sort of Shannon's backstory. And it was, you know, since I had written with Carlton, the episode that set up, Boone's backstory with him sleeping with Shannon, which is as icky now as it was then. Even though they're not blood relatives. No, they are, aren't they?
No, they're not.
Thank God. Yeah. So it was a while back, you know, I wish that I had gotten to put to dot that I the way that I got to with Leonard on the Sun and Jin story. You know, the Sun and Jin story really feels all of a piece in those two episodes. And of course there's more, but I mean, for me at the time that I was working on the show and that felt like a complete story and it was really nice. And, you know, I wish I'd gotten that chance to do that with Shannon and, you know, Liz wrote a great episode and God bless her. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's not so much something that I wanted that didn't get on the air. It's more like, you know, and look, there were many ideas for what the island was, you know,
right.
And the way that we did the show was that we would come up with something and it would sort of become our operating theory and maybe we wouldn't land on it hard in terms of, yes, this is what it is, but we always had something in the back of our minds that was what everything was, unless somebody came up with a better idea, which was sort of Damon's policy.
Uh-huh.
I had a very clear idea of what I thought the island was, and it was not incongruent with what the mainstream thought was among the writers of the show for what the island would be. It was something I feel, having only seen the finale and piecing together what I know about the show from what I've read about it and all that, it seems like the island could have been the thing that I thought it was when I was working on the show and that seemed to be kind of a big part of our thought on it, but it felt like a punt, you know? You know, ultimately, even though they said a lot about what the island was and all that, I mean, the fact that people are still asking, you know, tells you how specific they were and how hard they landed those points. I do wish that whether it was the idea that we had or something else, that they had been a little bit more specific about that. The backstories that we created in our original writer's room, which I will always give credit to Paul Dini, Jennifer Johnson, and Christian Taylor, who were there. I was there, and our job was to, you know, take, you know, meet with Damon and JJ, talk to them on the phone while they were in Hawaii filming the pilot, flesh out their ideas, come up with new ones, pitch them to them. It was a process of us being a think tank that would flesh out things that they proposed and added new things and get them approved and all of that stuff. So you're literally talking, there was a brain trust that helped develop literally what Lost became. And I always mention it and them because, you know, it's one of those parts of the process that can very easily get glossed over.
You've worked on so much good television since you left Lost, The 100, of course. And then, you know, most recently The Dark Crystal, which is this prequel series of the Jim Henson original film that's on Netflix that I've had a chance to see that is incredible and very intricate. And I can't imagine anything like that being made in 2004, but I'm just wondering if you could talk about some of the ways in which TV has changed since making it 2004. One thing that I can think off the top of my head is that, you know, people can drop in and catch up and binge watch and do whatever they need in order to get current. You don't have to recap previously on Lost like every time. So what else has changed?
I think what's happened more than anything else is, and frankly, the pendulum has turned so far in the opposite direction that like I literally go and pitch a show that is a story of the week show and people look at me like I'm an alien. I mean, they literally look at me like I walked in the room and said, hey, lick my face. I mean, it's weird. look, I think that one of the best things is that now serialized shows are serialized. And if you don't have a serialized show, you know, you can have a hybrid with some mythology episodes and not. But by and large, we don't have to do, you know, this weird tap dance that we did with Lost. You know, Dark Crystal is a serialized show. You can watch individual episodes and enjoy them because they all have, you know, they all have an individual story to tell, but they're all parts of a greater story. They're all attached. And, you know, like that's one of the great things about where TV is at now. They don't look at them as seasons. They look at them as events. You know, the first 10 hours of Dark Crystal will be one event. And then, you know, we'll continue the story later, hopefully, if people like it. And that'll be another event. And it'll have a beginning, middle, and end, but it'll be a continuation of the story. You know, Lost is a weird hybrid of that. And it's also a show that comes out of a time in television as late as 2006. And look, even today, the first thing everybody tells you when you pitch them a sci-fi show is it grounded? And you want to go like, Marvel literally ended a series of movies with an LGBT person of color riding a Pegasus, right? And hitting a spaceship with a sword. And you're asking me if shit's grounded, you know? And it's the highest grossing film of all time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but so even now, look, people my age and executives my age, we grew up in a time when genre was stigmatized. I remember having my agent would not put me up for a job on Star Trek because he insisted that the Star Trek shows were a ghetto, that I was going to be pegged as a genre writer, and I would never be able to get out of genre, and I would never be able to write prestige television. Anyway. and look, that was a fight that I had with my agent even up after Lost won an Emmy for Best Drama Series, an Emmy that I have, you know, with my name on it.
Right.
You know, so it's one of those things where that prejudice still exists, and it's gotten a lot better, and now you get stuff like Stranger Things and all that. But honestly, you still have to have an executive who is a genre fan, who understands genre, and who wants to do this kind of material. And even though the serialization curses off, we still have to deal with you know, people still believe that shows have to be for the broadest audience possible. And what our current age of television has told us is that, no, if you get enough of a small audience, you can still make a show for a lot of money, make it look great, and have it be exactly what it needs to be.
Yeah.
What's great about television now is that because there are so many outlets, there are so many audiences, and it is so easy to reach a large segment of a smaller audience, enough that you make your money back, shows can be so much more specific and so much true to what their creators want. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, I've benefited from that enormously. You know, when I think of the Dark Crystal is such a lark and such an improbable thing to exist at the money we made it for, at the scope of it.
Yeah, I keep talking to other TV writers who've seen the Dark Crystal and we're like, how does this exist? How did this come to be?
You don't even have to talk to other TV writers. You have to talk to the people who made it. Me and the guys who developed the show and I, you know, we ran the writer's room and we were, you know, like we literally look at each other daily because I'm working with them now on a bunch of other things. We look at each other daily and go, how did we get away with that? How'd that even happen?
Right.
And we would do that literally we'd come in and we'd be like, well, today the Gelfling are going to do X, Y, and Z and they're going to fight this and all that. And we're like, can you believe that sentence just came out of your mouth? I'm like, no, it's wonderful. I mean, and by the way, that's the magic of where television is at today. It's not just The Dark Crystal. It's a show like Atlanta. It's a show like Maniac. You know, it's a show like Vida. You know, it's not just about genre. It's about the Latino experience. It's about the weirdness of some Norwegian, you know, show that was made in Norway for a buck and a half. And then, you know, a bunch of weirdos here take it over to make it even stranger, you know, like, and those shows can't, I mean, look at Russian Doll, you know. I mean, it's like it's not just about genre. It's about all of the things that you couldn't do in broadcast because broadcast financially had to appeal to everyone, and that's why they called it broadcast. You know, I think that the downside of that, however, is that there are things. Look, the downside of that is that now you go on Netflix and you watch one of these 10 episode shows, and the first four episodes are essentially the glorified first 30 minutes of a movie. You know. And some shows you have to watch 5 hours of it to figure out what the hell the show's about. And if you find out the show's not about something you're happy with, you're like, Jesus Christ, I spent 5 hours doing this, you know? And that's the part that just annoys me, because one of the things that is getting lost in the craft of television, with the medium changing so radically so quickly, is that the ability to build a world concisely, You know, the ability to tell a story concisely is being lost to this idea that you can decompress everything all to hell, you know. And by the way, we were guilty of beginning that trend on Lost, but I feel like we did it with purpose. And I feel like, you know, a lot of what you see now is just inexperience. You know, you see a lot of creators come in who've only done movies or only done, you know, a Twitter or, you know, a this or a blog yeah. or a play or something. And, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I wrote an essay that went viral. Now I have a TV show. And it's not to say that their ideas aren't good, right. but the execution of those ideas makes a lot of mistakes that TV figured out how not to make a lot of years ago.
Right. You know? And I think a lot of that removing of stigma around genre television can be traced back to Lost. Like, doesn't this feel like a huge swing in terms of how the mainstream culture feels about genre storytelling?
There's two shows, and, you know, I got a lot of dirty looks from Carlton in the writer's room because I would say routinely that Galactica was the best genre show on television, right. which it also tell you that I didn't really look at Lost as a genre show. I thought Lost was a kind of hybrid soap opera, you know, thriller with some supernatural elements in it. But really, I mean, more than anything else, Lost was a metaphysical soap opera, you know, and Galactica, I think between Lost and Galactica, you have the two poles of the show, you know, one show that was working in a very mainstream media space and had to tap dance around genre, but did that in a way that actually made it more palatable and actually made it a phenomenon, right? And then you've got Galactica on the Sci-Fi Channel, which everybody who loves genre is looking right. at and going, this is like the best allegory for the war in Iraq that we've ever seen, you know, but not everybody can get over the barrier to entry, but so many people did because the show was so good at articulating modern themes to its genre. So I think between those two things, you know, us doing the best possible version of a mainstream broadcast show with genre elements and Galactica leaning into their genre, but also leaning into the allegorical potential of genre. I think between those two, you get the, you get where genre is at today. And of course you also can't discount the fact that, you know, there is a huge percentage of TV writers who came up watching Buffy, yeah. watching Star Trek, you know, like, Gen X is, you know, the people who grew up in Gen X are now showrunners. You know, the biggest sort of population of showrunners are Gen Xers. We grew up with genre. The executives are, you know, Gen Xers are graying and we're moving into those senior management positions in the executive ranks too. We have a high tolerance for genre because we grew up yep. with Star Wars, you know. That's the cultural event that defined most of our desire to get into film and television anyway. So, you know, I think it's a combination of us being very early in a vanguard and then also just generationally the world catching up to the idea that genre isn't, you know, some sort of foul smelling, you know, nerdy thing that has to be kept in a basement, you know?
Right, right. So it's been so interesting to watch people watch Lost through the lens of 2019. There's so many elements of the show that in 2004 felt cutting edge and completely progressive. And then there are other aspects of the show that don't age particularly well when you look at them 15 years later. I'm wondering if there's anything that sticks out to you in that regard.
Well, you know what? First of all, I think that watching Lost now is sort of like, you know, when I saw Lord of the Rings in the theater, when I saw the Fellowship of the Ring, the thing, and I was not a Ring kid. I was a Narnia kid. Like I never got past Tom Bombadil. So this was all new to me, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, you got to admit those Tom Bombadil chapters are just like, I mean, that's a hard sit, right?
Oh, come on. So many songs.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, you know what? Of all the shit I say in this interview, this is the one that's going to get a brick through the front window of my house. You know?
From the Bombadil stand.
The Tom Bombadil lunatic fringe is going to come after me. No, but I'll tell you what, like, I think that, so when I watched the Fellowship of the Rings in the theater, there were parts of it that you just go like, this is so familiar. And you realize it's because everybody ripped off Tolkien.
Right.
I mean, everybody ripped off Tolkien. So it's really hard to do Tolkien, even when you have the resources Peter Jackson did, without the audience watching that and going, this is really familiar. Because right. even the part when they all see Rivendell and they'll go, Rivendell, Rivendell, Rivendell. Like, I wanted to, like, literally, I turned into Terry Gilliam and went, it's only a model. You know? like even that has been ripped off, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things where, like, I feel like watching Lost now is like, you know, if you don't watch Psycho before you're 10 years old, the twist isn't going to surprise you because you've seen it ripped off everywhere. Right. And I think that when you, a lot of the devices that we used on Lost that were considered so far reaching and so visionary on just a formal level, everybody's using that. I mean, literally within a year, everybody was cribbing all of our best moves, you know? So that's part of it. Look, I think also, I mean, how can you look at the pilot and not look at the opening shot of Shannon and not cringe? I mean, it is as objectifying a shot as it can be. So, I mean, you know, that even that scene where Kate is sort of cleaning herself in the pond and Jack sees her. I mean, even stuff like that, like you go like, well, you know, maybe we could have handled that a little bit more thoughtfully. I mean, I'm watching even, and that's become so dyed in the wool. You know, I'm not going to say what the show is, but I'm watching a show right now where, you know, all the female characters like spend most of the first episode running around in their boy shorts and tank tops, but all the men are fully dressed. I'm like, why is this happening this way? You know? I think that there's a lot of that, you know, a lot of just those choices that we made directorially and visually vis-a-vis our female characters. I mean, I don't know. What have people told you they find reprehensible about what we did? I'm curious.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say reprehensible, but I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that you've mentioned, I think the character that has aged the best in the last 15 years or that people's perspective has shifted a lot on is Shannon. I think what I'm finding of our 2019 viewers is an audience sort of yearning to empathize with Shannon in a way that I don't think people were interested in doing so in 2004. And then on the flip side of that, I would say Charlie and to a certain extent Jack are two character types that maybe haven't aged super well in terms of their masculine possessiveness.
Well, look, Jack. Yeah, I think Jack is a standard bearer for brooding, a kind of brooding man pain, daddy issues, you know, thing. That doesn't play as well, partially because as my generation has taken over television, look, I wrote another essay about the alleged golden age of television and what I think brought it about. And look, I think when you look at shows made by predominantly men my age, you're looking at an entire canon of work that's entirely about bad parenting. You know, I mean, even 24 is about bad parenting. You know, Mad Men is about bad parenting. You know, Grey's Anatomy really is about bad mentorship and bad parenting and how, you know, like bad parenting has turned good people into narcissistic workaholics, you know, who can only find fulfillment within this hospital. You know, it's The Sopranos is about bad parenting. Like literally so many of these shows that and Sopranos was not made by someone in my generation, but it's certainly indicative of that overwhelming theme because my generation was the first generation to grow up with divorce as an acceptable cultural event, you know. My generation was the one where divorce first hit that 50% mark, you know, and before that people got divorced and then they got talked about a lot and, you know, and everybody else just drank a lot. So, you know, so I think one of the reasons why Jack has not aged well as a character is that, you know, look, since then we've had 10 years of daddy issues and everybody's freaking daddy issues. And like, you get tired of daddy issues, you know? And I think one of the nice shifts as Gen Y becomes more, so their voice becomes more vividly heard in television, all that is that we're moving away from that trope. And I've certainly tried to, in my own work, just get away from that because it's tedious. It's tiresome, you know? And by the way, I named an episode All the Best Cowboys Have Daddy Issues. So that tells you that by episode 10, I think it's episode 9 or 10, I already was kind of like, Jesus Christ, man, you know? So
it's such a good title, though.
Well, thank you.
All right, and this is the time of the show where we take a few moments to thank some of our most trusted emissaries out there in podcast land, the Small Council, members of our Patreon, as always, patreon.com/stormofspoilers. Guys, I would like to thank the following people for being members of the Small Council this week. We've got Amber Plotje. Yeah, I think I nailed that one. We've also got Chad. We've got Jennifer Holloway, Daniel Keeling, SM, Lauren Biscaldi, Eric Stratton, Cody Dixon, Christopher Schnaze, yeah, Rana, Raquel Azevedo McKenney, John Pinge, Jessica Capossi, Lisa Beauregard, Kyle Clark, Sydney, Aaron, Corinne, and Miranda Lane. I got all the ones with no last name.
I want to thank Claire C., Alexander Schultz, Jeff Baer, Laura Mingle, Lisa, Schwabenbauer, Abe, wow. I was like, did okay in Schwabenbauer and then got hung up on Abby Bateman, Martine Bateman, Victoria Yoder, Natalia Gould, I think this is probably Carolyn, Caitlin McCarthy, Brandy Franklin, Rajiv Dasani, David Felice, Dana O'Keefe, Megan Raybone, Chris B, Laura Bonar, Pekka Koskimaki. There you go. And Chase. Thank you guys so much. And just a real quick reminder, if we bungled your name in any way before we get to Dave, you can message our producer Diana in our Patreon Slack and she'll put a little pronunciation guide for us. So if we've messed
okay,
it up.
Now Dave goes.
Now Dave.
Great. And I'd like to thank these people whose name I'm probably pronouncing completely correctly. Shannon Black, Sean Embrolt, Emily Sully, Dan Allen, Susan Flanagan, Henry McGreen, Jax Frankovich, Zachary McQueeston, Matt Terrell, Jennifer Boucher, yes, Michael, Christina Brosius, Rachel Fisher Bramble, Monty Cross, Christina Tricate. Yes, I'm going to say that and not do like a beer pronunciation. Brian Moon, Susan Kusush, Daniel Shepard, Vicky Huang, and Rip Van Ruben, which is all one word.
Crushed it.
I'm assuming is pronounced Rip Van Ruben. Thank you guys so much, and we will see you for pronunciation corrections in the Slack.
Christina Tricate.
And that sound of old clickety-clack means we're here in the storm to talk about all our storm thoughts.
Do you want to hear part two of Rachel's email?
Oh, we should definitely start with part two of Rachel's email before, because the lock, who knows what team lock, she is a rabbit hole. Let's email first.
Okay, so Rachel, whose email I definitely still have in front of me, and I'm not pulling up because I lost it. There it is. She says, on a totally unrelated note, we just started watching, speaking of old clickety clack. On a totally unrelated note, we just watched The Substitute, which starts with a trip around the island from the POV of the old clickety clack. I have this strong memory of a similar shot from Twin Peaks, the original, where we followed Bob on a terrifying romp through the forest, ending with an owl coming into frame. Does this sound familiar? Twin Peaks, by the way, had the spot of my all-time favorite show until Lost came around. I was so obsessed with this show that I would set my VCR, yep, it was the 90s, to make sure I never missed an episode, if only the internet had been a thing when the show was on. Anyway, thanks for being the bright spot of my week. Love the pod, your humor, and takes on this great show. So, the old clickety-clack tour around the island.
Did you guys see the tweet last week? This is Twin Peaks relevant?
Remind me. What was it?
David Lynch tweeted out a screenshot of what appears to be the complete Blu-ray collection of Twin Peaks called Twin Peaks Z to A.
Yeah, I got it.
That apparently will have two Ultra HD 4K upgrades. One of the pilot and the other of season 3, episode 8.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. I got a press release about that. And what was interesting in that press release, I think, is that it's like limited. I think they're doing, Twin Peaks from Z to A. And they're only making 25,000 of them.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah.
I'm going to spend. See, this is where I feel I have not ever bought the complete Twin Peaks before, so I'm probably going to drop an obscene amount of money on this. But I do feel bad for the people who are like OG fans who are like, another format I have to own the complete Twin Peaks on. Son of a bitch. All right. Anyway, that was a lot of talk about Twin Peaks, which is a great show.
Relevant to this episode because of that part where they talk backwards. So, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Is that what all it
is? One of the many disorienting things.
It's them backwards? It sounds... I guess I never noticed that it was the words backwards. I thought it was just jumbled.
Oh, according to Lostpedia, it's just their dialogue backwards, and I listened to it while I was watching it this time, and it definitely sounds like that to me. So.
Mm, okay.
I think that once you know it, you can hear it that way. So it sounds very Red Roomy. You want to talk about Locke?
I think so. I would like to re-ask the question of when did Locke know that Walt burned the raft and how?
Right, because John blaming the others for burning the raft, even though maybe he knows that Walt did it, is very much like John saying maybe Said was conked up by Sawyer, even though he knows he did it. By the way, I can't remember if we ever talked about that, if we've talked about it in the calm. I hope not, because that's not revealed, I think, until season 3, that John is the one who conked Said. So
yeah, I don't feel think like we've talked about the storm.
Okay, good. All
right. Yeah. But the whole idea that Locke's on team stay on the island at this point makes me wonder, you know, if he saw Walt light it on fire, and if so, he shows up so conveniently, especially in the past two episodes, right when one thing said to the right person can change their viewpoint of how they're on the island, and he's knocking over way too many of these pins in a row. I guess the only person he hasn't saved is Charlie, probably because it'd be redundant for him to like save Charlie again after the heroin thing, but he's still going around like island saving people and knowing where he like ends up, and that he's now like obsessed with a hatch somewhere out in the forest. Just makes it all seem really sinister to me. And the show, you know, wants you to be somewhat paranoid of him. And I think that, the cinematography used to make you uncertain of him, like how they keep him very, moist and rimlit, and, how he smiles at, inappropriate times. Those tricks are all, you know, meant to make you feel uneasy. Knowing what we know now about him eventually being a conduit for the evil part of the island does, I think, leave open the question of how much he's being influenced at this moment and how much is actually, John Locke, who had a bad father, trying to make things better.
I just disagree with you. I don't think he's being influenced. I think he's just like, he's being like seduced is sort of a thing that I, you know, like he's meant to feel special in silent. So he's like bought into this narrative of like, but influence makes it sound like he's like being Grima Wormtongued or something like that. And I don't think that that's quite the case. Do you know?
Yeah. I think to me, it feels even simpler where it's like this idea that the show needs ways to keep John Locke in the story, even though we know like his character would rather be out there digging up the hatch. But they need to use Terry O'Quinn because he's great. So it's like this function of them having insert Locke into these stories. But also I think at this point in the show, the way it seemed like they were writing the show was they were hesitant to do too much of the sci-fi stuff, but they loved feeding the mystery. Like they loved feeding the idea that like something weird is happening with John Locke. So I think they just like sort of leaned into that a little bit. And, you know, I think these are the ways that they found to bring Locke back into the story. And it does feel, it does get to the point, especially in this episode, where it just feels like he's like popping up at the right moment all the time. But it's like, I don't know. You got to use Terry O'Quinn if you got him.
I guess for devil's advocate points moving forward, I'm saying like if the island can make Locke feel something when he's close to the hatch, what if it's making him feel something when he's close to Boar Camp or feel something at night when he has to watch Walt light the
What do you mean make him
raft on fire?
Make him feel something.
Like the island told him that Walt burned down the thing, or like the island led him to seeing Walt?
Yes.
I think like you're giving the island too much credit.
Yeah.
especially at this point.
What do you mean feel something when he's close to the hatch?
Because he's like, don't you feel it? And Boone's like, no, I'm going back. And what he's feeling is his proximity to the hatch. Like, whatever the island is it sending him, like, some sort of weird signal.
See, I always read that as, like, Locke feeling his destiny or his sense of purpose. Like, do you feel that we're close to finding out the answers to the thing?
I mean, maybe, but
I've never
that's
thought
a
of
thing,
it as, like,
if that's
physical
a feeling.
Physically attracted to the hatch.
Yeah.
I mean, which is weird to say out loud.
physically attracted to that.
John's
going to try and fuck that hatch.
this part of the podcast is coming after my conversation with Javi, but something that I was reminded of when I was reading his great blog post, the Grigio Marx Watch Lost Will and Testament thing, is that JJ wanted to have the hatch door in like the pilot episode.
Right.
Like, that's your mystery box, right?
And then the network was like, nope.
No, it wasn't the network. Damon didn't want to do hatch until he knew what was in the hatch. And so
this point, he knows what's in the hatch, which is great.
Yeah. So like it doesn't show up until like episode 10, because it didn't show up until, according to this blog post from Javi, that like Damon comes charging into the writer's room and is like, I know there's a guy in there and he has to press the button every 108 minutes. Like that's all he knows, I think, so far. So that's kind of fun, because
or the world ends is the last piece of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So like they didn't show the hatch until that, which I really,
I love that that's enough of an idea to be like, all right, the hatch is good now, because I would have been like, I have a lot of other questions.
Well, I love this idea of the Lost Writers Room, that like the mythology is the mythology until someone comes up with a better explanation for it. Like, right. This is the story until someone tops it. And I love that. Like, that's a sort of competitive, like, thing. Speaking of which, but I mean, it leads to some retconning and like, so, which is fine. I really don't mind that, like, when a writer's room changes its mind later on, about certain things, that's fine. But just to clarify some stuff in Sun's timeline, she does know what her father does before, Jin comes home with blood all over him, because we see her in a later episode, season 3, episode DOC, coming to him demanding money because Jin's mother is blackmailing her. So she goes to her dad and she demands $100,000, and he's like, what makes you think I'm gonna give you $100,000? She's like, because I pretended my whole life not to know what you do, but I do know what you do, so give me $100,000. So like, Sun definitely knows. And then she also, in this episode, you know, Jin says his dad is dead, and then we find out that his dad is alive, and we think that's something just Jin knows, but we find out later that Sun knew as well, because she tracks him down and talks to him and stuff like that. So, it's interesting that, like, Sun has this secret, like, she's learned English and she hasn't told her husband, and that's like, that was a first thing they sort of cracked about Sun. But as the series goes on and we find out that Sun, like, was having an affair and, like, then later, like, is doing business with Charles Widmore, does a hostile succession style takeover of her father's company, and cracks Ben over the head with an oar later on. Like, Sun is just basically, like, a much, 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 much more formidable, don't underestimate her at your peril. Like, she actually lies more than you might think, character on the show. I don't think I realized that until my most recent rewatch, like, what they decided to do with, cause in that first episode, I think it's Glass Ballerina, where, like, you think maybe she's having an affair, but it ends as if she isn't. And she swears to Jin, no, I was not having, this is definitely your baby. Like, don't even worry about it. And then we find out a later episode that she was having an affair and she doesn't know if it was his baby. And I'm like, I believed you, Sun. What the hell? So I don't know. It's just an interesting thing that they're playing with, through all of this.
I forgot about DOC, you said it was?
Yeah, DOC.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, Son of DOC, that's all about Son and Jin's baby, and which is apparently would have to be conceived around now, right?
According to Juliet's math, the baby would have been conceived right around now, but this is where they're fighting.
But we all know women can't do math.
Well, I prefer to think that it was conceived. I like to think that the baby's conceived when, like, when there's this episode where, when Jin comes back, like, he's been on the raft and then he's like taken by Ana Lucia and blah, blah, blah. And then he comes back and then they definitely have sex. And she, like, there's this shot where he like walks out of the tent and Sun is like standing behind him and he's like, yeah, what's up? And everyone's like, okay. That's when he gets his handcuff off too. He doesn't get his handcuff off until season 2, episode 9, which is interesting, because I think that's symbolic of like him fully sort of integrating into the camp is when he gets the handcuff off his wrist finally. So
Yes. So you're saying it's also male birth control is a single handcuff.
Yeah, it works, guys. Try it. Please do.
Wait, no, don't.
Please don't. Yeah. Everybody was like, aren't you paying attention to the greater themes of Lost that all fathers are trash? Except for Jin's father. Cool.
I have some other things to talk about, if that's okay.
Yes,
once again,
go for it.
I apologize to our reviewer who hates the sound of my voice, but I like how this episode sets up. Once again, it feels like the confidence of the back nine. It sets up Kate as particularly intolerant of husbands who mistreat their wives, which is something we will revisit with Kate and her own father. So that's just, you know.
But also Kate being very soft on lying.
Yeah, also that. We also have...
Also Kate being kind of a shitty friend.
For the sake of a dramatic...
Right.
Shot.
For she's dramatic glare instead of being a good friend.
No, I think the camera wanted to show Sun all alone when in fact she would not have been alone, because I really feel like Kate would have been like, it's okay, dude, let's go Angry Garden or something.
Right. Or Jack would have tried to fix it.
Right.
You know, he loves trying to fix stuff.
He sure does. Locke says to Walt, do you have an opponent, right, in the backgammon, or vice versa? One of them says that to the other. That's a fun thought. I thought Dave would love that most of all. And then Locke also says everyone gets a new life on this island. And literally, after Locke dies, his appearance gets a new life on the island. Do you know what I mean? Like... Also, I should have said this in comp, but I feel like we should be drinking for, like, tabula rasa references. Anytime someone's like, you could just shake the Etch-A-Sketch on this here Island of Mystery.
I want carte blanche.
Yeah, tabula rasa. New life, whatever the case may be. Anyway, yeah, I think that's all the stuff I have. I don't know, I think it's interesting. To think about Sun and maybe the shifting ideas they had about who they, you know, because I feel like in these early episodes, she's very much like, your sympathies are entirely with her. She's doing the best she can. She married this guy. She thought he was going to be nice. He turns out he was an asshole. Both. So not that I can't find sympathy for her in those actions, but like that's definitely shading on that character that we don't have.
It was what we were saying about the Mobisode, or what I was saying about the Mobisode, which like I have no doubt that that could have happened with those characters in this story world.
Yeah.
It just would have felt out of place to see it happen, given where we are with our characters at the moment. But yeah, you know, Sun and Michael totally kissed at least once. Come on. Almost. No. Maybe even to incompletely. Who knows?
Wow. Right.
2019 re-edit.
I mean, if they had pursued that romance, then maybe Michael would have had a plot line after his son was taken. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that seemed to be the other Michael plot line, is like, Michael's got this son and also this crush on, he's got a son and a son, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, two sons.
Two sons. But yeah, I don't know.
It's a Star Wars Rebels episode. All right. Neil, where are we off to next week?
Oh boy, we are going to check back in with the somber, quiet human who ended this week's episode. We're going to get a little Harley action with Numbers, which I think, you know, if at this point anyone who's watching Lost for the first time is still listening, you've been very brave. You've seen a lot of spoilers. This is a great episode. Like, this is an episode. This is one of those you put on the calendar and you think, oh yeah, this is where it gets really good. So I'm very excited to dig into Numbers next week. It's a Hurley episode. So it's great.
And I believe we have a very good guest for that episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, Joanna, we always have amazing guests for every episode.
That's true.
Of the Star Wars Lost Rewatch podcast. But yeah, until then, where can people find more of your work online? Let's keep it rolling with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Oh, you get me over at FilmSchoolRejects.com on Twitter at Rejects. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcasts, where you can vote for the 2004 thing and all kinds of other fun stuff.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E and on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, wherever you find this podcast. Fighting in the War Room will also be there. Search for it. And also here, pumping through both your ear holes, telling you to stay upright, don't fall down.
Nino, see you next time.